Tonight on All Together Now, we preview the May 17th school elections. That's tomorrow, Tuesday, with interviews with David Little from the Rural Schools Association. And we also hear Vern Cross, Rainer Blue, and Kamal Johnson talk to Hudson City School Superintendent Marie Suttmeyer and School Business Administrator Sharifa Carbon, particularly about the Hudson School Board election and school budget elections and board member elections are going on throughout the region tomorrow. Check your local listings for time and location. We'll also hear a variety of stories from around the area. Hudson-based guitarist Alexander Turnquist, you're hearing behind us now, providing the instrumental breaks and the song of the day later on All Together Now.
Interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Accra, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is The Weekend in Review. Some of the stories that made the news between May 13th through May 15th. I'm Philip Grant. At the top of the news, Brian Nearing reported at Capitol Confidential that State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman's office last week asked the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to delay action on its December 2014 approval of the 125-mile Constitution Pipeline. Last month, the State Department of Environmental Conservation denied environmental permits to the project, which would bring natural gas to Schoharie County from Pennsylvania. Schneiderman also urged FERC to consider fining the company up to $1 million a day if it turns out developers encourage landowners along the pipeline route to cut down trees before they receive state permits. The Attorney General's office conducted a two-month investigation into the pipeline project, finding evidence of tree cutting, road building, and heavy equipment use in state-protected streams and wetlands. The Daily Freeman reported that the Hudson Flag Day Parade will be held on June 11th, and organizers are seeking individuals or groups who would be interested in participating. They say they are looking for any interested groups, including community groups, churches, fire companies, youth groups, and businesses. Participants can march, enter a vehicle, or build a float. Information is available at HudsonFlagDayParade.org. W.T. Eckert reported for the Johnson News Service that a St. Lawrence County jury last week returned a verdict of guilty in the sex abuse trial of former Dutchess County legislator Michael N. Kelsey. The former Republican state assembly candidate was found guilty of sexual abuse and attempted sexual assault, both felonies. The incident that led to the charges occurred in August of 2015 when Kelsey was leading a Boy Scout troop from Fishkill on a week-long stay at a camp located between Cranberry Lake and Pierceville. Kelsey will be held in jail without bail until his July the 8th sentencing. The Daily Freeman reported that Ulster County says a test of the water in the county-owned building at 50 Center Street in Ellensville last month showed no excessive level of lead. The test was conducted by Environmental Lab Works Incorporated, the county said. News of the Ellenville test result came just days after the county reported water in 17 county-owned or leased buildings showed lead levels in the water at or above the EPA cutoff mark. 16 of the buildings are located in the city of Kingston, one in the town of Ulster. The county believes the lead problems reported came from pipes in the buildings, not the municipal water sources. The Zephyr Teach Out campaign announced last week that she and fellow Democrat Will Yandick will hold three debates next month. None of the debates will be held in the immediate area. The first will be held on June the 7th in Woodstock with Brian Hollander of the Woodstock Times moderating. The second, June the 8th, will be held in Oneata and will be moderated by the League of Women Voters. And a televised debate on June the 15th will be broadcast on Time Warner Cable with Liz Benjamin, Editor-in-Chief of Time Warner's State of Politics, as moderator. Teach Out and Yandick face off in the June 28th primary for the Democratic line in the general election. The winner will compete with the winner of the Republican primary, either John Faso or Andrew Haney, to replace U.S. Representative Chris Gibson in the 19th Congressional District. Yandick will be a guest on All Together Now on WGXC at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, May the 17th. The Register Star reported that the American Farmland Trust has announced $110,000 in grants to the Columbia Land Conservancy and five other partner organizations in the Hudson Valley FarmLink Network. The FarmLink Network was founded in 2014 and is dedicated to connecting farmers and non-farming landowners of agricultural land. In the last 2 years, the network has worked in collaboration with groups like the Columbia Land Conservancy to train 600 farmers and landowners in transferring farms and farm leasing and help more than 75 farmers find land. The new grants will enable the Conservancy and its partner organization, Dutchess Land Conservancy, to work directly with farmers and landowners to facilitate the transfer of farmland to the next generation of farmers. And for our final story, Greg Hudson reported in the Daily Mail that more than 300 students graduated from the Columbia Green Community College on Saturday, May the 14th. College President James Campion conferred, and Phyllis Carito, Vice President and Dean of Academic Affairs, presented to candidates with 95 Associate in Arts degrees, 144 Associates in Science, 56 Associate in Applied Science, and 4 Associates in Occupational Science, as well as 28 certificates. Student speaker Brianna Masonbacher told her classmates and hundreds of family members that the diversity of their journeys united them and that their time of discovery together was meant to prepare them for a future of accomplishment.
National Weather Service says overnight the weather should be cold, cloudy with a low around 39. There's a chance of showers Tuesday morning, mainly after 11 a.m. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a high near 64 Tuesday. 20% chance of rain Tuesday night with a low around 40. Wednesday, there's a 20% chance of rain before 2 p.m. Then it should be partly sunny with a high near 64 and a low around 38. And Thursday should be sunny with a high near 65. I'm Tom Rowe for WGXC.
Unhappy about something you heard on All Together Now? Or maybe you have a strong opinion about an issue. Energy, agriculture, the environment, the Common Core standards, or broadband access. Don't keep it to yourself. Call 518-291-9492 and leave a 3-minute message, and we'll play it on the air. Leave a 3-minute message, 518-291-9492, with your take for all you hear. Again, that number is 518-291-9492. To leave a 3-minute message that may be played on All Together Now. Thanks for getting involved in your local community.
You are listening to the WGXC News Update. I'm Alana Medlock. Julia Reichel is reporting at the Watershed Post, a planned motorcycle protest against Islamburg, an African-American Sufi Muslim community in the Catskills, backfired on its organizers this weekend. When protesters showed, they were vastly outnumbered by hundreds of cheering Islamburg supporters, who gathered to defend the Delaware County community from charges that it is an, quote, Islamic Jihad training camp. American Bikers United Against Jihad planned to take a, quote, ride for national security past the community's entrance and the Islamburg sign that flanks it on Sunday, May 15th. The purpose of the ride, according to the group's website and Facebook event, was to call on the U.S. State Department to designate Islamburg and its parent organization, the Muslims of America, quote, an international terrorist organization. The bikers told the state police to expect 70 riders, but only 5 motorcyclists and 8 other vehicles materialized. Approximately 200 to 300 pro-Islamburg protesters showed and lined both sides of Rood's Creek Road in the town of Tompkins. An Islamberg spokesman said the hundreds of people who arrived to support the residents were making history for the small, once isolated community. Quote, we never had the opportunity to reach out to our neighbors like this. There have never been this many guests in Islamberg, he said. Read the full story at the Watershed Post. Ali Stewart at WTEN Albany reports that the five-month-old zebra missing in Palinville since Tuesday was found dead and has been buried. The zebra, named Zula, was spooked at the Bailiwick Animal Park and riding stables in Catskill, which set off a unique animal hunt on the mountaintop this weekend. Matthew Hamilton in Capital Confidential reports that Republican candidates in the 19th Congressional District primary, John Faso and Andrew Heaney, are sniping back and forth in a series of statements in recent days, with State Conservative Party Chairman Mike Long telling Heaney in a letter to, quote, knock it off. Faso's campaign first sent a cease and desist letter to Heaney May 12th for, quote, knowingly spreading falsehoods in advertisements and statements. The same day, Long, whose party has endorsed Faso, sent a letter telling Heaney to stop using, quote, dishonest tactics, and saying Faso is a, quote, courageous conservative stalwart. Heaney's campaign replied, quote, if anyone should knock it off, it's John Faso, end quote. The primary election is June 28th, with Will Yandick and Zephyr Teachout competing among Democrats. Read the full story in Capital Confidential. The March for Farmworker Justice left Smithtown on Long Island May 15th, heading to Albany with stops in Saugerties, Catskill, and Ravenna May 29th, 30th, and 31st. Marchers are attempting to bring attention to the need for legislative action to end the inequality that currently burdens farmworkers in the state. The New York Civil Liberties Union filed suit May 10th against the state and Governor Andrew Cuomo over the state not allowing farmworkers to organize. The group marches to Albany for Farmworker Albany Day, Wednesday, June 1st. Katie Kosajansky is reporting in the Daily Mail the Catskill Farmers Market will be back this year, but on a different night. Beginning June 3rd, the market will be open every Friday night from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Catskill Community Center. Erica Russo, the center's new outreach coordinator, said the market will run through October 14th. Russo said the center is hoping to promote the idea of healthy living and also the farm-to-table food movement. The goal is to have more farmers and bakers participate in the market and have healthier items offered for sale. Organizers are hoping to attract more farmers, have local breweries host tastings once or twice a month, and food trucks will be encouraged to be on site as well. Read the full story in the Daily Mail.
And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio Weekend in Review for today, Monday, the 16th day of May, 2016. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
All Together Now airs Monday through Saturday, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia Counties and WOOC LP 105.3 FM in Troy.
First tonight on All Together Now, we talked to David Little, the executive director of the Rural Schools Association, about school budget hearings and the May 17th school budget votes around the region.
All right. We're talking to David Little from the Rural Schools Association. David, you want to tell us what the Rural Schools Association is?
Sure. The Rural Schools Association of New York State is a not-for-profit association of about 315 public school districts throughout New York State that obviously focuses on the rural character of the school district. We also are in partnership with Cornell University, and I run the rural school program there, which operates the Center for Rural Schools, which is a data center, and
planning purposes, for demographic studies, for student performance studies, and we also obviously advocate on their behalf.
And we've brought you here today to give us a little information about, I guess, the school budget hearings and school elections that are, I guess the budget hearings start this week and the elections are May 17th. What is different about this year's school budgets that are being put together?
Well, the dramatic difference this year is twofold. One, we've legislatively created a funding crisis for our public school districts this year because New York State decided to one-up every other state in imposing its form of a tax cap. In virtually every other state that has a tax cap, you have either a 2.5% tax rate that's a cap, or you have the cap on the total spending of a municipality that includes the school district. So there's some flexibility in funding. New York State went a step further and said, we're not only going to have the lowest tax cap at 2%, but we're going to make it 2% or the rate of consumer inflation, whichever is lower. And the fact that this year consumer inflation is at zero has made the local property tax cap a local property tax freeze for school districts. And to make up for the fact that local school districts can't raise any additional revenue on their own, and in some cases actually have less money to spend under the tax cap than they had last year, the state needed to provide significantly more state aid than it did in this year's state budget. What they've done is left a number of school districts in a deficit situation or with the inability to meet their normal costs from year to year. What I would say about our consumer inflation link to the tax cap is that the things that consumers buy and what determines the consumer rate of inflation has absolutely nothing to do with the goods and services that a school district spends its money on. And so linking the two has created this unnatural situation that has left school districts needing by law to pay for things like contractual obligations to its instructional and non-instructional staff. But school districts spend money on things like running diesel fuel in their buses for, you know, perhaps 10 hours a day. Consumers obviously don't pay for that, but most importantly, consumers don't pay for employee health insurance that's in double digits, or for a state retirement system that has an increase that's also in double digits this year. And so when you have those kind of expenses and you're allowed no more money at either the state or the local level, the only thing that is left for you to do is to dismantle the educational programs and services that you provided in the year before. And that's absolutely inappropriate because the state is not hurting for money at present. Its economy is growing. It had the revenue available to be able to pay for a significant increase that would keep school districts from being in this bind, and yet it chose not to do so.
I want to understand both, why is something economic linked to something educational? Like, are students supposed to get smarter in years the economy is worse or something? Or and what would you advocate in place of the tax cap?
Well, here's the problem in New York State. In virtually every other state in the union, the state pays for two-thirds of the cost of public education, and local property taxpayers pay for one-third of the cost. In New York State, the state pays only 40% of the cost of public education, leaving 60% to the federal government and the vast majority, over 50%, to local taxpayers. That means in communities where local taxpayers have the ability to provide significant resources, you get a great education, and for those communities that cannot afford to provide significant resources, you get the absolute bare state minimum of curriculum. So even though many of our school districts graduate the vast majority of their kids, the education that they've received doesn't make them competitive either in the workplace or in college, because they haven't had the kind of curriculum and programs and services needed for them to be able to put the information they learn into any kind of context. So, you know, your question about whether public education, you know, ebbs and flows, you know, I always say that, you know, you can't fund public education with a chart that looks like an EKG that bounces up and down when public education is actually on an incline. It's sequential. It builds on itself. And if you get a couple of years where you take away programs and services from a child's education, study after study will tell you that that's non-recoverable, that they will never get back in the span of time that they have in their public education to where they should be to be able to be competitive when they leave school.
Next, Vern Cross, Rainier Blue, and Camille Johnson from the WGXC Afternoon Show on May 11th talk with Hudson City Schools Superintendent Maria Suttmeyer and School Business Administrator Sharif Carbon about the upcoming school board elections May 17th.
Here with us.
Let's do it.
And I'm going to put some respect on the name, because the one thing that made me laugh is, not, did I forget that she was a doctor? Maybe I forgot, you know, because maybe people don't say it enough. But when I realized it, we started saying that you have to use a doctor before that. We are honored to have Dr. Maria Suttmeyer, the superintendent of schools, in the building with the Drive Time team. I have to give you the applause. Sorry, guys. I'm saying she's a doctor. I'm saying applause.
Getting corporate on us today.
Hi, Maria. How are you today?
I'm good. Gee, thank you for that introduction. That was
I worked on it. I worked on it all night. I said, I can do this. So before we get started, I know that outside of the budget, and that's the very most important thing, but there's three seats open on the same day for the school board, correct?
That's right.
And the vote is that same day, right?
That's right.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure, because sometimes when there's votes for the school board, like for all the other elections, it's in the paper and everybody knows about it and it's posted everywhere. But it seems like the school board votes are never posted anywhere and you just don't know about it. Like, oh, I mean, when Joey Carr ran, we knew about that. And then I think when Tiffany Hamilton ran, because she had came to us and asked for some help. Yeah, I did throw that in there, but we go way back. But that's the only way we knew. But a lot of people, they might not even know where they have to vote at, more or less that there is an actual vote.
Right. So there's three open board seats, and there is bios on each one of them on our website. But we only have two people that are on the ballot. We have three seats, so someone can be written in.
Okay.
So if anyone expresses an interest in the community, they can be written in, or if somebody wants to nominate somebody, they can.
Okay. I just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, well, thank you. Tuesday, May 17th, three open board seats.
Okay. So let's talk about the budget.
Okay. So slight increase this year. We are the only school district in Columbia County that had a reduction in state aid. We got about 0.5% less than the surrounding school districts. The reason for that being that we had taken most of our gap elimination adjustment back in prior years. And also with decreasing debt service on our buildings, we didn't get as much in aid on our buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a 0.5% decrease. So we do have a tax levy that we are asking for voter support. It's 2.15%, and the overall budget is $45,910,371. Okay. So it's an education plan that we really talk about in the district. It's you're voting on the number, the budget, but you're really approving what the education plan is for the students of the Hudson City School District in the 16-17 school year.
Okay. I'm listening.
Okay. So, you know, we're really pleased that we don't have any cuts in staff this year, that we're really proud of the fact that we've been working hard to come off of the state designation of being a focused school district, and we want to keep that momentum going. We're actually adding some key positions next year. that provide additional support for our students that are learning English as a new language. We have a growing population of students that have mandated instruction time that they need. Also academic intervention services, a reading specialist we're bringing on, and a certified secondary English and dually certified special education teacher so that they can not only teach the English content but also use the strategies that are needed with our students that are identified for special services.
Okay.
The other added position this year for additional support for our students is a certified social worker at the secondary level. We find a need that we want our guidance counselors focusing on guiding our students towards college and career readiness, getting them prepared for what lies outside of the high school. So we want to remove some of the social-emotional work that they're doing with students and give that to a certified social worker so that they can see the students for that guidance that they need for preparation after high school. So we're really proud and think we have a well-rounded plan for next year and keeping a lot of other programs that have been influential in helping us to get off the focus status and improve our school climate and culture and make sure that we continue those as well as add on additional services, not becoming overly staffed with mm-hmm. unnecessary positions, but things that are really key positions for our students.
That's great.
How did you determine these positions that to be key for the district?
Right. We meet as an administrative team, so it's always a systemic look at our K through 12 grade levels and talking about what programs are in place that really seem to be making a difference in the lives of our students, what we want to preserve, and then areas where we have been seeing a gap, you know, an increasing of students coming in with English language learning and knowing that the mandated services that we need to provide for them, the need of the social-emotional development of our students. The board, when they helped us to set our goals for the Vision 2020 this year, added a fourth goal. So we're not only raising the bar of our academic expectations and closing the gap amongst our diverse subgroups of students and aligning our curriculum instruction, they felt that it was really important to have another element that's not academically based, but based on helping our students to understand the world around them and to survive day to day with all of the changes that are going through them from adolescence to young adulthood.
With the budget, when people go to vote, it's yes or no. What happens if, God forbid, if the budget doesn't pass? Then what happens?
Well, I'm going to pass it over to our school business administrator, Sharifa Carbon, because she is really connected to the budget and what would happen if it did not pass.
Welcome back.
Yeah, welcome
Thank
back.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Thank you for having us.
Time for radio news about radio waves.
Thanks, 10-4.
You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. Headlines.
David Oxenford in the Broadcast Law blog reports that the Federal Communications Commission begins requiring commercial radio stations to upload documents and make their public files available online. The requirement begins June 24th. but just in the top 50 radio markets and only for stations with five or more full-time employees. The station has their license, public comments, records of political ads, their EEO public inspection file reports and quarterly issues programs list, and other documents for the public to evaluate in these files. You can read the full story at the broadcast law blog.
Next, we have these reports.
The Zephyr Teach Out campaign announced on May 13th three debates with opponent Will Yandick, though none in the immediate area. The two will discuss issues June the 7th in Woodstock, with Brian Hollander of the Woodstock Times moderating, another by the League of Women Voters on June the 8th in Oneata, and a televised debate on Time Warner Cable June 15th with Liz Benjamin as moderator. Teach Out and Yandick have a June 28th primary to face either John Faso or Andrew Haney to replace Chris Gibson, Republican Kinderhook, in the 19th Congressional District. Yandick is a guest on All Together Now on WGXE at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, May the 17th. Finally, Melanie Lekashevich is reporting in the Greene County News that Coxsackie is the latest locality to pass a new law regulating solar energy, partially because the town itself is about to set up solar. A hearing for Coxsackie's Local Law No. 1 of 2016, Regulation and Approval Standards for Solar Collection Systems, was held at Town Hall on May 10th, and the town, village, and school district want to team up with a solar company to put panels on a property on Sunset Boulevard and Stacy Road. The new law is for both residential and commercial solar installations. Town Supervisor Richard Hand said, and I quote, "It is more stringent for commercial issues. The larger systems really need to be looked at and the impact they have on their neighbors. But at the same time, we need to be open to technology that is more friendly to our planet," end quote. You can read that full story in the Greene County News.
Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global, unembedded, independent, international investigative news hour, broadcasting live every weekday morning at 8 here on WGXC 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties.
I'm Philip Grant, one of the contributors to All Together Now. Listen to Democracy Now! In the morning and All Together Now! In the evening, WGXC's collaborative hour-long news show at 6 p.m., featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported, hands-on radio.
Democracy Now! At 8.
All Together Now! At 6 p.m.
Here on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Turn out or tune in to Amy Goodman, the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, Saturday, May 21st. She'll be there to help celebrate the start of WOOCLP, new low-power radio station run out of the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Tune in or turn out for a talk from Amy Goodman, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, Saturday, May 21st, in Troy and live on WGXC 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties.
William J. Kemble in the Daily Freeman reports that the New Paltz Village Board wants New York to divest pension money from a financial management fund that benefits Pilgrim Pipeline Holdings, LLC. On May 11th, Mayor Tim Rogers said at the town's board meeting, quote, "The New York State Pension Fund has investment holdings across a variety of different investment managers and several different funds under the Ares management umbrella. One of their funds in particular has Pilgrim as a portfolio," end quote. The company wants to build two 182-mile pipelines from Albany to Linden, New Jersey, moving natural gas to New Jersey and refined fuels north to Albany. Quote, "I believe we have significant leverage in that our pension fund has about $700 million of exposure across a variety of different funds that Ares, this behemoth of an investment management firm, is responsible for," end quote, the mayor said. No vote was taken, but Rogers said many other small towns along the pipeline's proposed route will consider similar divestment measures. Read the full story in the Daily Freeman. Scott Waldeman in Politico, New York, reports that the State Department of Environmental Conservation wants more information before ruling on a proposal to frack for natural gas in the southern tier using propane and sand rather than water. Tioga Partners, LLC, entered an application that the DEC has deemed incomplete that would get around Governor Andrew Cuomo's 2014 state ban on hydraulic fracturing. Under this proposal, the fracking would be done with liquefied petroleum gas and sand instead of water to split rocks to get to the gas.
Linda Collard, the DEC's Regional Mineral Resources Supervisor, said the department is trying to, quote, make a determination if this relatively unique fracturing technology that has not heretofore been subject to a full environmental analysis has the potential to cause significant adverse environmental impacts, end quote. Read the full story in Politico New York. Brian Nearing in the Albany Times Union reports that a series of energy-related protests kicked off around the Capital Region May 11th when climate protesters drove the head of federal energy policy from the stage at a conference of the Independent Power Producers of New York. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission Chairman Norman Bay was interrupted and shouted down by about a half a dozen protesters at the Desmond Hotel and Conference Center, leaving through a side door instead of finishing his speech. The protesters included Igor Vamos, a media professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and a founder of the Yes Men, a media protest group that holds fake press conferences and uses other stunt tactics to bring attention to social issues.
Diane Valden in the Columbia paper reports that an Ankrum farmer who has been certified organic since 1988 is worried about losing that label if a neighbor is allowed to use pesticides in a pond. Farmer Donald McLean, speaking during an April 21st public hearing on the town's right to farm law, said the proposed law does not address, quote, practices by non-farmers that could adversely affect a farmer's ability to farm, unquote. He's worried about the fruits, berries, and vegetables and grains that grow on his Thompson Finch farm, 750 Wiltsey Bridge Road, because Camp Pontiac wants to apply herbicides and algicides to Lower Rhoda Pond. Camp Pontiac, a sleepaway summer camp at 2044 County Route 7, has applied to the State Department of Environmental Conservation to use several pesticides to control nuisance aquatic vegetation for better swimming and boating. McLean doesn't want those pesticides floating down from Lower Rhoda into the Long Lake and then Roelof Jansen Kill, where he fears it could cost him the approval of the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York. The DEC is accepting comments on this project at an address on the WGXC Newsroom website. The Ankrum Town Board considers the right to farm law at 7 p.m. May 19th.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Teamsters Vice President John Murphy says his union is working with Congress to try to resolve problems with the Central States pension plan. That's because the problems it faces are also faced by other defined benefit pension plans nationwide. A law passed by Congress in 2014 allows multi-employer pension plans in crisis to cut retiree benefits. But when Central States submitted a plan to do that to the Treasury Department, it was rejected, saving retirees from cuts, but still not resolving the underfunding problem.
Treasury's rejection of the application was in large part based upon the public comments that the International Brotherhood of Teamsters had submitted in December of 15 and March of 2016. But we recognize that a lot more remains to be done, most notably that we have to come up with a way to solve the negative cash flow issue that Central States and other pension plans face. And so we're working very, very hard and will continue to work very hard with Congress in devising new ways to come up with money to solve the pension plan.
This is Mitch Lawrence with the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. Well, we might have seen the end of an era when the San Antonio Spurs were eliminated from the NBA playoffs the other night by the Oklahoma City Thunder. When the Spurs walked off the court, it might have been the last time we see Tim Duncan play in a basketball game. And that would be a shame because Duncan will go down as one of the greatest players of all time. Now, you can argue about which Laker was the greatest player ever, whether it was Jerry West, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Magic Johnson, or maybe even Kobe Bryant, who just retired. With many other NBA franchises, there is more than one candidate. When it comes to the Spurs, there is no debate. Their greatest player is Tim Duncan. He didn't just change your franchise, he put the Spurs on the NBA map. Before he arrived in 1997 from Wake Forest, the Spurs had never reached an NBA final, so they had no titles. They were a nice little team in sleepy South Texas that had come into the league in 1976 from the old American Basketball Association. But with Duncan's arrival and what he did for the last 20 years, he's been as synonymous with San Antonio as the Alamo. With Duncan leading the way, the Spurs won five titles, got to one other finals, and became what is considered the NBA's model franchise. But now he's 40, and when he leaves the arena, he limps out because of a bum knee. We hope he comes back for one more season, but if he doesn't, we'll be the first to wish happy trails to Tim Duncan.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers power professional is online at ibew.org. Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was called out by HBO's John Oliver May 15th for diverting funds meant to maintain and improve the 911 emergency call system in New York. On his Last Week Tonight television show, Oliver also mentioned that New York is one of the few states that do not coordinate their county 911 call centers statewide. And nationwide, Facebook or the Domino's Pizza app can tell exactly where your cell phone is calling from, but 911 operators are not getting that information, and emergency victims are left waiting while responders spend time figuring out where victims are located. Here's Oliver talking about Cuomo's actions on Last Week Tonight, Sunday, May 15th.
What makes this even more frustrating is that almost everyone's phone bill has a line like this on it, which you might assume goes directly to fund 911 centers. But the FCC's fee report showed that since 2008, at least 20 states have diverted those dollars elsewhere, which is probably why, depending on where you live, 911 may be a joke in your town. We are routinely raiding 911 to pay for other things. New York State, which has seen multiple breakdowns in its 911 systems, took in over $185 million in fees in 2014, but then diverted $77 million into the state's general fund, where it could be spent on pretty much anything. And yet, when the governor was asked about this, he blew it off.
Is that something in the budget process that you'll take a look at? Is it right for us to divert this money?
It is not an issue that has come up, and I haven't heard any local legislator raise it. But if it comes up, we'll look into it.
Okay, A, it just came up. B, legislators have raised the issue repeatedly since you've been in office. And C, not diverting money away from 911 is one of those things you shouldn't have to be told not to do. Like siphoning gas out of a fire truck to put in your dirt bike. Oh, look, no one's told me this is wrong, so if you'll excuse me, I'm gonna spin some donuts in that Arby's parking lot.
Unhappy about something you heard on All Together Now? Or maybe you have a strong opinion about an issue. Energy, agriculture, the environment, the Common Core standards, or broadband access. Don't keep it to yourself. Call 518-291-9492 and leave a 3-minute message, and we'll play it on the air. Leave a 3-minute message, 518-291-9492, with your take for all you hear. Again, that number is 518-291-9492. To leave a 3-minute message that may be played on All Together Now. Thanks for getting involved in your local community. Next, the national headlines from Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, May 16th, 2016. I'm Mary Sherman. In focus in today's national news, green groups brace for an upcoming court battle over the Clean Power Plan, restored voting rights for felons praised in Virginia, and a push today to end the number one cause of preventable death. At the top of the list, next month, the coal industry's challenge to the Clean Power Plan will be heard in district court in the nation's capital. As reporter Mike Clifford tells us, environmental groups say it's a waste of time because the transition to clean energy has already begun.
The plan places limits on heat-trapping carbon dioxide from power plants. The Supreme Court has temporarily halted the plan because its legal merits have been challenged. Lisa Pullman with the Natural Resources Council of Maine says New England states have been cleaning up their act under the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and the Clean Power Plan would help get the rest of the nation in line.
We have some of the worst ozone days on the coast because we're at the end of the tailpipe from all of the coal-fired power plants to the west of us. We would very much like for the rest of the states to catch up with what we're doing here in the Northeast with Reggie.
Peabody Energy, America's largest coal company, denies the scientific consensus on climate change and has said it joined with others in the coal industry and attorneys general from coal-producing states to protect what it calls affordable energy for American families.
Renewables, yes. Nuclear, no. That's the message environmentalists want New York's Public Service Commission to hear. The public comment period on a proposed clean energy standard ends on June 6. Jessica Azoulay with the Alliance for a Green Economy supports only part of the proposal, the part that requires utilities to generate 50% of the state's electricity from renewables by 2030.
Unfortunately, also tucked into this so-called clean energy standard is a massive consumer subsidy for dirty, dangerous, and expensive nuclear power plants.
The governor says three upstate power plants are critical to achieving reductions in carbon dioxide and other harmful emissions called for in the clean energy standard. Democratic voters in Oregon and Kentucky will cast ballots in primaries tomorrow. And candidates running for office in Oregon's primary can receive an unlimited amount of campaign contributions from individual donors. But advocates of campaign finance reform are still hoping that can change. More from Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon Supreme Court has ruled money caps unconstitutional. Norman Turrell is head of Oregon's League of Women Voters and was part of a task force on campaign finance reform set up by the legislature. He says large contributions can be a way to buy influence.
The contributions might be tens of thousands of dollars at times, and that would get the attention of any candidate usually.
The task force advised state lawmakers to amend the Constitution to allow limits if another measure were passed by voters. Oregon is one of only six holdout states without a ceiling on individual contributions.
In other elections news, Governor Terry McAuliffe restoring the vote for Virginia felons goes in the opposite direction of an ugly national trend, according to voting rights activists.
Judith Dianis with the Advancement Project says numerous states have taken steps to restrict ballot access over the last 5 years. She says many of those restrictions hit minorities and are just kicking in now. Diana says Virginia's tough rule against felons voting is part of a discriminatory history, and she praises McAuliffe's step.
We saw the political voice of black communities in Virginia being silenced, so this move is huge. Now the task is to register those people.
McAuliffe's executive order doesn't change state law and could be reversed by a future governor. Dan Hyman reporting.
According to the latest numbers from the State Department, over 1,700 Syrian refugees have been resettled in the U.S. over the past 7 months, about 17% of the 10,000 the U.S. has promised to resettle by the end of September. In Missouri, a refugee family from Syria will speak this week as part of an effort to end the fear some may have about people settling in the U.S. after fleeing their war-torn countries.
The Syrian refugee crisis has created a lot of rhetoric in the United States, which has created fear and even hate by some toward immigrants and Muslim Americans. It's also led some state leaders to reject the resettlement of the refugees. Ira Harrett with the American Friends Service Committee says an exaggerated perception of threat has also increased levels of fear and anxiety and inflamed racial and ethnic tensions in schools and communities.
And we've also seen politicians use that fear and threat to further their own interests and to appeal to xenophobes and racists.
American Friends Service Committee has put together a series of public forums, with the next one slated for Thursday at the Public Library's Plaza Branch in Kansas City. I'm Veronica Carter reporting.
Smoking and tobacco use are still the number one cause of preventable disease and death, and today is Prevention of Tobacco Use Day. Michelle McCure, Director of Tobacco Control and Lung Health for the American Lung Association in Wisconsin, says with tobacco use, prevention is paramount.
And so we want folks to recognize and understand that if they are smoking or using tobacco, that there is help for them. Prevention is key. If we can prevent our youth from even starting and experimenting, then we're going to be that much further ahead learning. So really concerned about those youth who are starting. So we need to really make sure that we are addressing those prevention efforts with our youth.
She says the quickest, least invasive, and least expensive way to treat disease is to prevent it from occurring, and that every dollar spent in tobacco prevention saves $3 in healthcare costs. I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported and online at publicnewsservice.org.
National Weather Service says overnight the weather should be cold, cloudy with a low around 39. There's a chance of showers Tuesday morning, mainly after 11 a.m. Otherwise, mostly cloudy with a high near 64 Tuesday. 20% chance of rain Tuesday night with a low around 40. Wednesday, there's a 20% chance of rain before 2 p.m. Then it should be partly sunny with a high near 64 and a low around 38. And Thursday should be sunny with a high near 65. I'm Tom Rowe for WGXC. This is Tom Rowe with the community calendar. You can go to wgxc.org, click on the community calendar, and click on the calendar page. At the top of the page, there's an add an event button, and you can add your own event to the community calendar. Folks like me will read it on the radio. Folks around the world will see it online at wgxc.org in the community calendar. On Tuesday, May 17th, the statewide school budget votes are being held throughout the area. Vote for the to approve or not the school budgets in your localities for the 2016-2017 school year to elect Board of Education members. Check newsroom at wgxc.org for polling locations and more information. Alana State Historic Site also has a healthy hike on Tuesday, May 17th. That's from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. WGXC has a Community Programming Advisory Committee meeting from 5:30 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the WGXC Hudson Studio. That's at 704 Columbia Street on the second floor. Hunter has a town board meeting May 17th at 7 p.m. in Tannersville. Hudson has its Common Council meeting Tuesday, May 17th at 7 p.m. That's after the Hudson Finance Committee meets at 5:30 p.m. Durham has a town meeting on Tuesday, May 17th at 7:30 p.m. at the Durham Town Hall.
Next, it's time for the Hudson Valley Song of the Day, a performance from a musician visiting the Capital Region or Hudson Valley, or who regularly plays around these parts.
Today's Song of the Day is from Hudson-based guitarist Alexander Turnquist. This is Finding the Butterfly from Flying Fantasy. We've been listening to Alexander Turnquist's instrumental work on the instrumental breaks throughout this edition of All Together Now. Thank you.